Good evening, this is Lesbian Nation. Tonight, I've finally coerced my friend Catherine McHarg to read some of her poetry. And of course, we're going to start off with another little gem from Mary Flowerpot.
Yes, this is Mary Flowerpot again. Hello, everybody. Well, there's not been much coming in the way of post this week. In fact, I've just had this one postcard, which is rather grubby and without a stamp. It's written in newspaper-clipped letters in an illiterate hand, which reads as follows. Get out of town before high noon, Mary, or else. Signed, The Hooded Rider. Or else what, I wonder? Hooded Rider, indeed. You don't know what you're up against. This is what I've got to say to you. Take that. Fire! And that. Keep me covered, engineer. I can hide behind this microphone all day, too. All night as well. They've got beds here, you know. So don't think I care about you. I don't care at all. Thank you, David. David! He's really getting carried away. I'll have to switch him off. Now on to this week's theme, which is also a clue to the story. So if you haven't guessed it yet, listeners, I'll tell you that in this instalment, Mary Flowerpot uncovers the startling mystery of Sally Lime, the third woman. Who was the third woman? What was she like? Where did she come from? Where was she going? What was she doing? How old was her grandmother? Did she care? Anyway, why the third woman? What happened to the first and the second? If you have any answers to these baffling questions, write them on a postcard to me. Mary Flowerpot, Special Interpol Investigative Agent, Women's Division. So that I can get on with this thing here. Thank you. Now, as I have my information, Sally Lime, the one-time school chum of mine, was lost in the ruins of post-war Vienna, war-torn, crumbling into chaos. We had fought in the resistance together. We had come through thick and thin. We have been devoted to each other and our cause, so there was friendship and patriotism to draw us together. Oh boy, am I overworking this one. Let's see. Well, just play that lot together and see how it sounds stereophonically.
Idealism and good faith of our government, but sometimes I do wish that our beloved Uncle Sam would stay at home and mind his own business. Someday we may get our fingers burned.
Tell that to the government, Horatio. Listeners, as you may have realized, this film does not have to make sense. Unless you want it to, then of course it will. But if it doesn't, don't strain. We are not insured beyond 8mm. However, here is a program note to help you. This is the most structured film I have made so far. Dome and halls of the Capitol building, single-framed by dividing the magnification of a 5-to-1 zoom into 11 equal parts to produce a filmatic framework of symmetric distribution, that is, an ascending-descending symmetrical integer in series equated to an extreme asymmetrical distribution, single-frame shots as a rigorous mathematical function of the zoom magnification. That is, repeated 4 times in the film over 768 frames each. The first part is superimposed by a travelling mat system made by punching 6mm magnetic stock using an AES-R33 computer terminal. The dots moving over the dome of the Capitol building represent a strict visual analogue of a poem I wrote some time ago. This poem is transformed into a visual representation as a function of the AS2 code. So specific horizontal lines of the dots stand for given letters of each word from the poem. When the dots cross the interface of the photographic replica of the Capitol building, they instantaneously turn to a negative image replacement. The film continues by linking in subjectively chosen images of Richard Nixon, filmed off an editor screen, increasing projection time by a factor of 2.
Oh my God! The engineer shot himself with his own magnetic tape. Oh, well, that's the end of him. I'll have to go out and find another one. Well, I'm sorry about that, folks. I guess what we'll have to do is leave it until next week. I can give you a little more of the theme, and then we'll continue the next instalment.
My good buddy, Catherine McHarg, is a woman who got me into the women's movement. And she's been writing poetry for as long as I've known her and before. And as far as I know, never read her stuff publicly.
Never.
Why?
Never had the opportunity, I think.
Catherine is busy pushing the mic away.
It's very difficult.
Okay, want to start with one?
Yeah, most of them don't have any titles. This is a sort of up poem. I am not trapped this year as I was before, because I know where people are, where meetings meet. I can go to Women's Lib, or GLF, or DOB. I can call my friends, too, and go to movies. It's only late at night when I come home, because no single friend invites me to go with her, because no one is in love with me or I with her. It's then that panic strikes, no one to hold.
Well, it starts out up.
Some kind of offbeat jazz weaves me back to noisy clubs somewhere between 59 and 61 and my first trip to the village. I'm sitting in the basement of a bar. What was it called? The Salt Box. And temporarily I'm content with my melancholy gin and Collins mix to be alone in a city that scares me with its bigness and its strangers, its glamour and its lost nights. Chloe. Remember Chloe upstairs at the bar, mother. Lover in my fantasy only, where it's safe, where she loves me, takes me home forever. Chloe with a bleached, southern, accented, 45-year, liquored, laughing hair must have caught me staring, eyes scary, pleading, take me home with you. Did she remember me years later in that dingy bar in Chinatown, something Mott Street, wearing her faded cardigan, serving drinks in the afternoon? Peterson, that was her last name. Andy must have told me. He knew everyone then at his bar. She worked at the Cinderella Club, the MC, he said there. I called her once and a girl answered. Chloe was somebody's mother. And once she had a lover too, but neither one was me.
Yeah, I know. I have one that reminds me of somehow. This is somebody I never got to bed with either. Called to my friend Miriam. She was never athletic, yet by sitting still, tensed for a shower of blows, her shoulders had secreted muscle. Never the schoolgirl of unconscious grace, not the fair-haired leader, most certainly not the sweetheart of Sigma Chi, she had acquired a tough butch rep of late, crossed between a Casanova and a hood, and half believed in it herself. So I was surprised, but most of all, she was surprised to know that she had been beside a fire, beside a woman drinking wine, talking, unable to reach for a waiting hand, talking until it became absurdly late, and they retired in polite dismay to separate rooms.
For Judy Garland. She's called Judy. What good is it if thousands say they loved you now? When, even if you could hear them, as so often you did, vow their adoration, you would not believe, you could not believe now or then or ever, as you lay alone on some cold tile, whose adoring smile came to your dying mind? Perhaps your own. Yes, perhaps your own. This is written at midnight. Just because I read about a dance scheduled for tonight on this week's Rat and had no other plans except to work, I pushed the have to go inside my head while balking, as I've done so many times before when there was something that I thought I should attend for my own good. Knowing it was loneliness that pushed me out and fear of finding no one pulled me back. So now I say I'm tired and it's late. Too late to dress and drive myself to town, and dances by myself are just a down, though so is staying home when I can't sleep. What kind of rest is this? Sorry. I lie in bed and flip the TV dials and still can't sleep. I smoke and sip my coffee while that voice behind my eyes repeats, "You should go out. It's for your good. You might meet someone there." I know I won't. Not in the mood I'm in, I argue back. It hasn't happened yet that I've met someone when in such need as this. Why should it now? Why should I now? I'm too self-conscious to find love tonight. I used to live on East 6th Street, as you know. There were two, they're kind of short, they're just called East 6th. A multicolored wall, red paint, white sink, blue tub, green towels on silver rack, with the careful nonchalance of a finger painting signed, "I am colorblind." But is it dated? I hate this room now because it's my failure, my present, my now. And success lies only in the past. I can't see how this ugly room will ever become the past. The second part is a little bit different. I had a place once on East 6th Street, I'll say, smiling wistfully, as if some secret suddenly remembered itself. Yes, yes, that was the place that, and trailing off into mumbles, into silence, I'll start to frown and look pensive. And finally, not waiting to be asked, I'll announce flatly, calmly, with no feeling whatsoever, that I hated the place on East 6th Street.
Good old Lower East Side.
Patricia asked me to read this one. It's a very short poem. It's about trees, about the trees at City College. It's just called The Trees. Symbols of unreality, your rustling wind-played leaves by artificiality shut out. And nature grieves in silence while the brass street sounds blast crashing notes, thrashing through each blade of grass, wrapping static round your throats. This doesn't have a title either. On a day encased by gray rain across the city lay the ageless woman with cracked eyes, shifting limbs along the bed, drifting back from dreams to dead reality, where death's the one surprise left or ever to be tasted. And all joys are born wasted, like future pints of menstrual blood from faceless children never seen. And what mountain stream is green enough to swallow up such flood of crimson? Pondering the dominance of green, the woman in her trance stood wearily in her darkened room and touched herself without feeling, her putty smooth fingers sealing up her self-sufficient tomb.
That reminds me of a poem I wrote when I was a welfare worker.
Oh, what a coincidence.
Yeah, both worked in the same path. Yeah. For Mary, whom I first met but last week, hidden under counterpane and quilts, her shawl draped over wisps of hair. Was it chill or vanity or piety that covered her balding head? She said, "It hurts all through my system." I gave some sympathy, but not much credence to vague illnesses. Then I was 21. How should I know? She said, "I listen to the radio, but sometimes I get bored." Cataracts had closed her off. Of course, her teeth were gone. But she spoke clearly. The priest says mass in the morning. Because she could not see, I held her bone-thin hand. And that's all I remember. Blue eyes and a sallow face and a cold blue hand. On Monday next, we were notified she died. And we stopped sending the welfare checks.
You got more personally involved than I did. How many years ago was that?
That was when I first started to work for the department. When you first start, you get involved.
Yeah. Sure, are you the one about Dykes?
Mm-hmm.
The name of this paper is Why I Like Dykes, or preferably Why I Like Dykes. If I say they and mean she, it won't mean anything to me, and therefore to anyone else either. So I will try to avoid saying neither and use them both. They are strong, independent, and refuse to go along with the commoners. She stays miles above straight women in knowing how to love straight women, gay women, whichever, both. The capable dyke is often quite loath to be strictly defined as female, or worse, to be confined to she-male. Only the asses see the world through it and box themselves in with a cock or a clit. But the dyke I admire must be one who's a whole lot like me. Neurotic as hell and never quite well. Always hurts somewhere, but too proud to yell. Makes love on occasion and doesn't brag. A little old-fashioned, but never goes drag. Believes in total honesty on the whole, with nothing to hide except her own soul. Quite a bit missing still, I feel, as I fall short of my own ideal. And so do we all. All fall short. Even dykes are not what they purport to be. But I don't trust the measure used by men for their own pleasure, passed on to women to placate their men, the rules of being feminine. What do they mean? Their callous classification forever used to strangle imagination, to stifle every woman's every breath with mass prenatal mental death. It used to be with corsets and stays the man would take our breath away. But in the youth of me and you, a football in the gut would do, or a line drive by an older brother, or a subtle expectation to mother some bastard or other. Oh, fuck this. All I want is to hug and kiss any woman I happen to like. Guess that makes me a regular dyke.
You get your dyke button.
I get it free, that's good. This is about also about being dyke. But all those people should live alone, my father said. I've heard worse fates stated. Is it truly gay to be alone when you awake? It can make 8 cups of coffee just for you, thinking somewhere in your head that later she will be there and she drinks coffee by the ton. Is it just fulfillment of some prophecy to find that you have lived alone for too long to remember? You ask yourself some mornings, who was here? Who was she who made me feel alive before? When was I ever happy? Am I now? Perhaps I am. At least I know I'm gay.
I don't know if you know this one. It's called I'm Being Asked, What Do You Do? Not much this week. I haven't been very diligent at hunting up perversions in mysterious haunts unknown to solid citizens. I read the Times this morning and was quite depressed at the success of the rich and mighty in keeping the poor from daycare centers. This week I have a cold, but notwithstanding various afflictions of flesh and spirit, managed to screw a reading lamp into the wall above my bed. When I was 17, on seeing the word lesbian in some cheap paperback, I got excited, thought of mysterious and wicked practices which I would practice on mysterious and wicked women. 10 years later, being gay is every day, and I tried reading books on witchcraft by my reading lamp. But physics texts seem more exciting, perhaps because I have a different faith than Cotton Mather did. Frankly, when I have a cold, I'd rather have a bowl of soup and reread all my comic books than play the evil dyke corrupting someone's inexperienced brat. Today especially, I feel depleted, like I haven't got even one little perversion left in the world.
Do you know German? You know German, right, Mark?
A few words.
Yeah, okay. This is called Und das Leben. Walking east on 22nd Street from 9th Avenue, I passed a German church. Ich bin der Weg, die Wahrheit und das Leben. And next to it, an alleyway that shirts the building's bodice, where a neat and narrow pavement winds its ribbon gray. Had it been the usual lifeless scene, occasional papers, boxes, crates I've seen so many times, I wouldn't have stopped today to look, for I was tired, close to death almost, grudging every step I took. unwilling to spare sparse energy to look at anyone, conscious of every breath, as of some tedious act of will. But catching at my eye's periphery was an infinitesimal movement, das Leben. It surprised me, so I stepped back and stood as still as the iron fence that I was peering through, as separate as that which separated my scene from me. Somewhat stiffly, I imitated the crisscrossed metal gate my hand clung to. A black striped circle of fur rocked slightly back and forth, and at first sight seemed one cat doubled up with feet upright. But there were two, folded over, locked together, breast to breast, with room between just so one could nurse the other, bigger cat, of course, the mother, who was intently licking unseen familiar fur. Die Wahrheit? Her green eyes closed, her thin tongue clicking down with firm, tender strokes, each tangled hair on that soft, slender stomach. With what force they imposed their unrehearsed familiarity on my unwavering vision. I stood staring, knowing I should go, and yet not daring to stir, to interrupt their intimacy, unwilling to walk away from what I'd found and felt peculiarly to be my own. Included while excluded, I alone was witness to that microcosmic mound of movement. Und das Leben. This is kind of a Victorian sonnet. Could I but see your face, your fingers now, or for an instant feel your mouth on mine, or watch the small, thin wrinklings of your brow move in and out, trying to trace the line of every thought, as if the changing pace could be controlled at all, or by some trick of kinesthetic sense recorded on your face, or see you smoking your cigar and flicking ashes off with careful grace, or smell one brief, sweet, pungent odor from your thigh, then I could bear this loneliness quite well while you're away, and kill this will to die or sit secluded in a darkened room, sealing your lack around me like a tomb. I hate to read.
That's one of the things I was impressed with your poetry. The fact that you could do a sonnet like, you know, like nothing, and, you know, I couldn't do one to save my soul, at least not a decent one.
They're more like exercises than, they're not as free-flowing as it, you know. I like the way you write because it's free. It's like, you just write, you talk, and it comes out poetry. But a sonnet has to be really disciplined. I have several. I thought you wanted to hear one of those, by the way.
So I do.
This is the first sonnet I tried. It's just called Number One. If you find you have the need to trace us back, to map the many meaningless phrases we exchanged, remarking roots with rages or sullen silences like signs of wasteland that no one ever saw but you, you think, because I was too crass to care about the landscape of our love affair, and let our love be littered with refuse like pasts cast off along the road, to cite each tear's source with a gray dot gruesomely pulled from your pencil-perfect memory. And after you have traced each day, each night, if still you do not know or cannot see at what point things went wrong with us, blame me.
Really neat.
This is another sonnet, number two. I am consoled by minor things today. The sting of smoke in my nose, the scratch of wool on my neck, the spilling from my overfull cup of coffee, upset by my cat at play, the hair that falls on the page as I write, and when I blow it off, it flutters up, then settles soundlessly in my coffee cup. So I ease it out and examine the white, black, tan progression leading to the black tip, struck anew by the beauty of the hair that covers my clothes, my desk, and almost anywhere my cat may choose to bathe or scratch his back. Such small distractions comfort me today that keep me from writing what I dare not say. It's called Youth. My youth was spent in fallow fields where gray skies swallowed up the shadows of my cares, and fantasy brought friends enough to spare. In fog or rain or bitter cold, my play was just the same, my game of solitaire, imaginary horses with blonde hair. With all my brothers gone a different way, I was the lonely hero on the stair, whipping thick, rough reins across the air, whispering my clenched command to stay, resting my outstretched hand upon the fair, silky neck of my Palomino mare. We rode on dreams of freedom through the days, clearing streams and trees, a fearless pair, following fortune's fancy anywhere. And when I slept, they kept the snakes at bay. No evil demons of the dark would dare imaginary horses with blonde hair.
This is Lesbian Nation. Good night.